Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. According to the National Institute of Mental Health, an estimated 16.2 million adults in the United States have had at least one major depressive episode. Low levels of serotonin and dopamine have been linked to depression, but where depression comes from and what to do about it still isn't clear. Edward Bulmore's new book from Picador, The Inflamed Mind, A Radical New Approach to Depression, takes a fresh look at the science of mental health and suggests a radical theory that the root cause of depression may be inflammation of the brain. Edward Bulmore is the head of the Department of Psychiatry at Cambridge University and a leading expert on depression and inflammation. He's also served as a clinical research director at GlaxoSmithKline. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
Hi.
It probably surprises most people that in 2030, the leading cause of disability worldwide won't be heart disease, diabetes, cancer, or obesity, but it'll be depression. What does that mean, and what will that look like?
Well, I think it's going to be quite similar to what we have already. I mean, if you look at the sort of list of medical causes of disability now, depression is number 2 or 3, depending on how you count it. If you look at the top 10, many of them are psychiatric, schizophrenia, addiction, depression. You know, these are very, very common causes of disability already.
Can you define what clinical depression is?
Well, there is a formal definition. And you know, the standard definition is enshrined in this document called DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, that's produced by the American Psychiatric Association. That sets out a list of symptoms. And you have to have had those symptoms for a certain period of time. And if you've had enough of them, then that qualifies you for a diagnosis of depression. So it's symptoms like low mood, loss of pleasure in life, disturbance of sleep, disturbance of appetite, social withdrawal, ideas of guilt, a tendency to self-harm, feeling pessimistic about the future. Those, you know, these are the familiar symptoms of depression.
You mentioned guilt. You write, for a lot of patients, depression is likely to be seen as a sign of personal failure. So
yes.
People blame themselves for being depressed?
Yes, I think that's quite a common trap. You know, I think people get depressed, they feel guilty, they feel self-critical. They think, well, you know, is it my fault that I'm feeling like this? Am I worthy of feeling any better? I think that's one way in which people get trapped in depression. It shames them, or they don't feel that they have a right to seek treatment. So, you know, I think one thing that's very important for people who may be listening to this that are feeling depressed is, you know, don't be ashamed to speak out about your symptoms and to seek treatment.
How long do people typically struggle with depression before they seek treatment?
Well, it's very variable. You know, I mean, I think a lot of us have had depressive symptoms, you know, not necessarily amounting to a diagnosis of clinical depression, but I think we all have some personal familiarity with the symptoms I listed that may have come and gone, you know, in a matter of days. I think where people seek treatment, it's when the symptoms are enduring, when they're very severe, and when they're beginning to impact on the rest of life, you know, when they're beginning to make a difference to relationships, employment, and so on.
On a non-medical level, don't many people have to struggle with depression when they've lost a loved one, or
yes,
lost a job, or suffered from some other loss?
Yes. Yeah, of course.
Does that trigger the inflammation that you're talking about, or does the inflammation trigger the depression?
Well, all of the things that you just mentioned, particularly sort of loss of employment, bereavement, those, you know, you could call those major social stresses or major life events, as they're described in the literature. And we know that those are just about the biggest single cause of depression. People have estimated maybe 80% of clinical depression is predicted by a social stress of that nature. So we know that stress is a very important cause of depression, and that's very well established. I think what we haven't understood so clearly is how stress causes depression. And I think that is turning into an interesting line of inquiry in relation to inflammation, because it turns out that actually social stresses can trigger an immune response, can make you inflamed. Mm. If you're bereaved, if you've lost a loved one, there's going to be an inflammatory response in your body on average.
The immune system is affected.
Yes.
Wow. What things would friends and family or colleagues notice in someone who's struggling with depression? Is it something that's immediately noticeable?
Well, not necessarily, because, as we've already discussed a little bit, there is a stigma around depression. People won't necessarily shout it from the rooftops if they're feeling depressed. They may be ashamed of their symptoms. And, of course, an aspect of depression is social withdrawal. It'll tend to pull people out of close relationships and perhaps make it more difficult for them to communicate to loved ones how they're feeling. So it isn't always the case that, you would immediately know that your partner or somebody else that you were very close to was feeling depressed.
But it's interesting that there's a stigma attached to it, since it's also so common.
Yes. I mean, there's a stigma around psychiatric disease, mental health disorders in general, I would say. And you might wonder, well, why is that? The way I think about it is that there's always been a stigma associated with any disorder that we don't understand, that we can't control. If you look back historically, there was much more of a stigma and a culture of silence around cancer, for example. If you go back further still, tuberculosis, a very stigmatized disease. Epilepsy, very stigmatized. And I think it's because we fear disorders, we fear diseases of which we are ignorant, which we don't have any control over.
But you also link some thinking by Descartes into all of that. Cartesian dualism. The concept of dualism, I think, goes all the way back to ancient Greek thought. But Descartes is the one who actually came up with the word, and that has affected scientific thinking ever since?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it certainly affected medical thinking. Descartes was brilliant, sort of solitary genius of the classic type. He worked alone. He made a lot of his discoveries simply by lying in bed and reading and thinking. And he conceived this split between the body, which he regarded as a machine that behaved in a certain way as a machine in the physical world, in contrast to actually what he talked about it as the soul. So he was a religious man who thought that there was a sort of divine spark in each of us, and then there was the body, which was a machine-like entity that lived in the physical world, just like an animal or a machine. And using his mathematical abilities and his scientific acumen, he began to sort of explore how you could understand the body machine. And that has been an incredibly important perspective for hundreds of years since. A lot of the triumphs of Western medicine are based on the idea that the body can be understood mechanically as cells and proteins interacting with each other to cause disease, and we can treat it on that basis. So it's been a big win in many ways, but it has left to one side this question of what Descartes originally described as the soul, what we would probably now call the mind. In his scheme of things, that couldn't be mechanically understood, and it wasn't very clearly linked to the body machine. In his original scheme, the pineal gland was supposed to be the kind of pivotal point where Deus ex machina, the god and the machine, joined together. And that idea kind of collapsed pretty quickly. We still are vague, I think, about how the mind relates to the body machine.
But how does that lead to stigmatizing people who are depressed or have other mental problems?
Well, because I think if you accept that there's that kind of dualist split between body and mind, and then you say, symptoms like depression are kind of coming out of the mind side of that that dichotomy, I think it makes people think that they should have responsibility for their symptoms in the same way that they have responsibility for their thoughts, their emotions, and many of their other mental experiences.
According to an article in The Guardian, a British newspaper, the background risk of depression in the general population is about 1 in 4. Mm-hmm. Each of us has a 25% chance of becoming depressed at some point in our lives. And if your parents have been depressed, your risk jumps by a factor of 3.
Yep.
So depression also runs in a family. Is that because of our body chemistries, or simply because of the same way that alcoholism will run in a family? Your parents drank and you drink. I know I smoked for years because my parents smoked.
Yeah. So, you know, it's the nature-nurture question, isn't it? And how do you disentangle those two things? And, you know, one
Nature-nurture is the big issue here for me in many of the questions that I might come
right.
up with.
Okay. Well, you know, how can you get at that? You can. There are various different ways you can do it. You can look at, for example, twins. If you're an identical twin, do you have a higher risk of sharing the same disorder compared to non-identical twins?
Do they? If one twin is schizophrenic, is the other one likely to be schizophrenic?
Yes. There's not a perfect correspondence, but there is a much higher risk of being schizophrenic or depressed if you have an identical twin that is schizophrenic or depressed. And that's one piece of evidence, because identical twins, of course, the DNA is 100% the same. So if you can see that there's a greater correspondence of disease in those twin pairs compared to non-identical twin pairs that only share 50% of their DNA, that's telling you something about a significant genetic contribution. Now, the question is what genes particularly might cause depression. And that has been a difficult question until very recently. But it turns out that once we've got big enough numbers, you know, you need hundreds of thousands of cases of depression compared to non-depressed, healthy people to identify the genes. But as those numbers have accumulated, we've just recently begun to see some pretty robust evidence that there are specific genes associated with the risk for depression.
I said that the number is 1 in 4. Is that on the rise?
I think it's difficult to say whether it's on the rise or not. I think a lot of people feel that depression is becoming more prevalent, more obvious in our lives. But whether that's because there's a real increase in the rate, or whether we're just becoming a bit more bold and a bit more outspoken about depression, and it's therefore just rising in part kind of visibility, is difficult to say at this stage.
People must be curious about it, because your book is now a bestseller on Amazon.
Yes.
Obviously, a lot of people want to understand why they're depressed or why a loved one is depressed. Are teens, young adults, and mostly women generally more likely to become depressed?
Yes.
Do we know why?
I wish we did. You know, particularly adolescence, you know, is a time of increased risk for all sorts of mental health disorders.
Well, our bodies are going through changes anyway, and we're likely to see schizophrenia in a young adult.
That's right. That's the classic time for schizophrenia to emerge. Why is that? You know, we know that the brain is going through a lot of developmental changes during adolescence, and particularly the sort of the bits of the brain that are important in what you might call higher-level functions, the sort of more advanced cognitive functions and the cognitive control over emotion. Those systems, those brain networks, we know are rather late to develop, and that could be part of the reason why we see this kind of spike in depressive symptoms and depressive disorders in adolescence, particularly in young women during adolescence.
Is that likely because of there's another nurture-nature? What is it? Is it due to social or physical causes? Because I could understand why a number of women would say, my circumstances have led to my depression.
Yeah. Well, you know, these are difficult questions to untangle. And other people are looking very actively at the sort of nature side of this. Is there, for example, a difference in how the brain develops in young women that might explain the differential risk that they have for depressive symptoms? I think, you know, we're still feeling our way with that. It's not entirely clear that we have I don't feel that I have a clear explanation why that should be, but I think it could give us a very important clue to what causes depression if we could understand what it is about being a young woman. 14 to 17 is the sort of peak period. Why in that period are we seeing so many symptoms? And it could be social. You know, there's a lot of social.
It could be hormonal, you're suggesting.
It could be hormonal. Or it could be some combination of these factors. I mean, you know, if I may say, I mean, one of the things that has bedeviled our thinking about depression and mental health disorders in general is probably the legacy of that kind of Cartesian issue that we were talking about earlier, the kind of split between mind and body. I think that still kind of pervades our thinking about mental health. You know, is it all in the mind? Is it all in the brain? One of the things that I think the immunological perspective maybe brings to depression is a sort of more joined up approach, which allows us to think about depression as a disorder of the mind, brain, and body in a social environment.
I'm speaking with Edward Bullmore, B-U-L-L-M-O-R-E. His book, The Inflamed Mind, A Radical New Approach to Depression. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM in New York. You also address Darwin's theory of natural selection. Is there a survival advantage to depression that accounts for its prevalence?
Well, that's, you know, I would say there has to be. Because I think I believe we are the product of natural selection. And it's difficult to see how something as common as depression could have evolved if it didn't confer some kind of advantage. Now, that's not obvious what that advantage would be, because if you look at what it is to be depressed now, you know, depressed people will generally, people who have chronic severe depression I'm talking about, will generally have more difficulty establishing a stable partnership. They will have more difficulty reproducing. The outcomes for their children may be impaired. So there's a lot of ways in which depression doesn't apparently improve survival, either of the individual or of their offspring. And so you've got to think, well, maybe phrase the question differently. Not so much what's the survival advantage of depressive behaviors now, but what could have been the survival advantage of depressive behaviors in the past. And one of the theories that I talk about in the book, it's not my theory originally, it's one that I've drawn from other work in the field, is that when we're inflamed, and if we become inflamed, let's say in response to infection, which going back in time was the major challenge to our survival, it could have been advantageous to us in terms of surviving those kind of risks to survival, infectious disease, if the inflammatory response included some of the behavioral changes that we now recognize as depression.
Because they're self-protective in an odd way, although
yes,
sometimes they do lead to suicide.
Yes, but in the evolutionary theory, which, like a lot of evolutionary theories, is somewhat speculative in nature, is that if you and I were living together in a kind of ancestral tribe and I became infected, it could be advantageous to my survival that I withdraw from my normal duties within the tribe. I have reduced energy. I spend more time trying to recover from that wound, from that infection. And these are behaviors that you can imagine could have promoted survival in that environment, but in our current environment might look a lot like depression.
Is this unique to humans? Because it's my sense that some other mammals, especially elephants,
mm-hmm.
Monkeys, even my dog sometimes mm-hmm. Looks like he can be depressed.
Yeah. Well, I think that question, so the short answer to that question is it's definitely not uniquely human that you see these behavioral changes associated with infection or inflammation. In fact, it's a very replicable, robust observation across a number of different mammals.
In the 1990s, there was a focus on the levels of neurotransmitters, mm-hmm. dopamine, serotonin, to explain why people develop depression. Can you talk about that time and the work
yeah.
that was being done then?
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating story. And it's a fascinating story of sort of the role of accident in science and medicine, if you will. What actually happened is that here in New York, there was an epidemic of tuberculosis back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And a lot of people with tuberculosis were sort of shipped out to a sanatorium called Seaview. I think it was on Staten Island. And it was a dismal place because at the time there was no cure for tuberculosis. People were essentially being quarantined by the city until many of them died. And in that context, it was tremendously exciting when the first antibiotics came out that could treat tuberculosis. And one of those antibiotics, is a drug called iproniazid, went into a clinical trial at Seaview in the 50s. And the doctors running the trial were astonished to discover that not only did it treat tuberculosis, it killed the tuberculosis germ, it also made patients happy. You know, there was a Life magazine ran a big feature. I think it was headlined "Dancing in the Wards," and there were photos of these tuberculosis patients smiling, grinning, dancing with the nurses. And some of the psychiatrists in New York at the time thought, "Well, this is very interesting. Why is it that this drug, iproniazid, is apparently improving the mood of these patients?" And they looked into the biochemistry of the drug, and they discovered that in addition to killing the tuberculosis germ, it also did something to the brain's metabolism of noradrenaline, which is a molecule very similar to serotonin. It's kind of boosted levels of adrenaline. And they were very quick to persuade the pharmaceutical industry at the time to run trials in depression, and they could show that even if you didn't have TB, if you didn't have tuberculosis, treatment with iproniazid seemed to shift mood, and it was licensed as the first antidepressant. And then very quickly, other pharmaceutical companies, other universities got involved, found other molecules that boosted noradrenaline or adrenaline and seemed to have antidepressant effects. And that gave rise to what has sometimes been called the kind of golden age of psychopharmacology in the early 60s, when suddenly there was a whole new raft of treatments available for these disorders.
We started hearing words like the word serotonin.
Right, exactly.
If this had happened earlier, Thomas Mann could not have written The Magic Mountain.
Yeah, well, yeah. I guess nothing is 100% progressive, right?
So what does serotonin do in the brain?
Well, it's
other than make us happier.
Well, okay, so here's the rub, in a sense. Although these drugs that boost levels of adrenaline, noradrenaline, serotonin, are effective as antidepressants, and although that implies that maybe there was some kind of deficit in adrenaline, noradrenaline, or serotonin before the drug was given to the patient, and that might be the cause of their depression, there's never been much evidence for that in humans. It's been very difficult to show that there really is a serotonin deficit in any particular patient that causes their depression. In the book, I tell a story. In fact, it's the first story I tell in the book about a patient I saw with depression back when I was just starting out in psychiatry. And, I'd read a few textbooks. I thought I knew a bit more than I did about where depression was coming from. And I remember talking to this patient, and he said to me, you know, I'm feeling bad about the future, I'm sleeping badly, I'm losing contact with my wife. And I said to him, well, I think you sound to me like you're depressed. And he was extremely unimpressed by that. He said, I know I'm depressed. That's why I asked my GP to come and see you. The question is, what are you going to do about it? And I said, oh, well, you know, we could offer you treatment with these new drugs. This was back in the early 1990s, the serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac. And I told him what I just read in the books about how serotonin was thought to cause depression. He said, well, how do you know that? How do you know that about me? How do you know my serotonin levels are low? There's some imbalance of serotonin metabolism in my brain. And we looked at each other for a split second, and I think we both realized that I had no idea what the answer to that question was. And I think it's important to realize that even now, when doctors are prescribing SSRIs for treatment of depression, we don't know in any particular patient that that drug is rationally justified by a deficit in serotonin, because we don't have good biomarkers or good ways of measuring serotonin in the brain.
But we do know that Prozac does have an effect.
It works, definitely.
Now, you mentioned biomarkers. They're used in most areas of medicine to evaluate treatment efficacy and patient progress. But that doesn't work with serotonin? Why do you think that is?
Well, it's very difficult to measure any particular molecule in the brain, in the human brain, in life. You know, we have very limited techniques for doing that. You know, people may be familiar with brain scanning technologies, MRI.
And you dealt with that early in your career.
I did a lot of MRI work.
MRIs on the brain.
And it's a fabulous technology. It can show you a great deal about the brain, particularly about the brain structure, but it can't measure many molecules very precisely. And particularly, it can't measure any of the molecules we're most interested in. It can't measure dopamine. It can't measure serotonin, for example. There are a few experimental scanning techniques. They're called positron emission tomography is one of them, or PET, that you can use to measure these kind of neurotransmitters in the human brain. But these are difficult techniques. They're dangerous. Dangerous in the sense that they involve exposure to radioactivity. Mm-hmm. They're difficult.
That's why MRIs are good, because
MRI is superbly safe and accessible. But it doesn't have that. It doesn't give you that fine-grained molecular readout, which is really what you'd want.
What were the questions that were being asked at the time that you were looking at those MRIs, and what did you learn
from the MRI research? Well, so this is going back a while. So I guess I started in MRI research in the early 1990s. And, at the time, one of the big questions was, is there any abnormality of the brain associated with psychiatric disorders? For example, a lot of people thought that schizophrenia, which is one of the most severe and disabling mental health disorders, the brain was, normal in terms of its structure, and that all of these symptoms came from sort of subtle derangement of dopamine signaling in the brain. So one of the big contributions of MRI and the other early neuroimaging research was simply to show beyond doubt that in most psychiatric disorders, actually there is clearly a structural sort of fingerprint of the disease.
So you could spot it?
Not in a single case, not in a single patient, but if you look, at a group of patients compared to a group of normal, non-psychotic comparison subjects, you can clearly see that there are differences in brain structure in schizophrenia. Yeah.
You're probably best known for your work on network neuroscience, or the connectome, is that what it's called?
That's it.
What does that entail?
Well, the brain is nothing if not a network, right? It's, trillions of cells connected to each other by synaptic interconnections to form this vastly complex network. And what the connectome really stands for an ambition, an aspiration, that we can begin to understand the complexity of the human brain network. And it's a word that was coined by a friend and colleague of mine called Olaf Spaans, who's a researcher based in Indiana University. He came up with that word in 2005, because that's about the time when we began to have the technology and the mathematical tools available to really make sense of brain imaging data and other data and understand the network organization of the human brain and other nervous systems. So that's, that's been a very, very active research area in the last 10 years.
My guest is Edward Bullmore, who is currently co-chair of Cambridge Neuroscience, scientific director of the Wolfson Brain Imaging Center, and head of the Department of Psychiatry at Cambridge University. And we are discussing his book, The Inflamed Mind, a Radical New Approach to Depression, which is published by Picador. In 2005, you took a position as a director of a clinical research unit with one of the big pharma companies, mm-hmm. GlaxoSmithKline, GSK. Can you tell us what brought you to GSK?
Yeah. By that stage, I was I'd been in full-time academic research for about 10, 15 years. I'd been a professor at Cambridge for about 6 years. I was in my mid-40s. I published lots of papers. There was a lot of progress in neuroimaging and understanding some of the issues that we were talking about earlier, the connectome and the network neuroscience, that was just beginning to come up pretty strong. So in many ways, very exciting. But if I looked across into the clinical side of my life, because, I've had continued to work clinically as a psychiatrist for much of my career, I was struck by...
You mean seeing patients? Yeah. Talk therapy?
Not particularly talk therapy, more, what in the UK would be sort of standard consultant psychiatry, which is mostly, to be honest, it's drug treatment based, but you'll often work with clinical psychologists and others as part of a team. So psychotherapy could be part of the treatment option as well. So I was working clinically, I was working in research, and the research I could see was going ahead, scientifically very strong, but it didn't seem to be having much impact on the clinical side of life. There was very little was changing in how we were talking to patients about their problems and what kind of treatments we were offering them. And so I became a bit restless, to be honest, about the prospects of really making a difference to mental health outcomes by continuing to focus, exclusively on this kind of academic interest in neuroimaging and brain network organization. And I thought it would be interesting to understand more about, how we could perhaps find better treatments. I had an opportunity to work half-time for a drug company, which at the time was very active in the field of psychiatry. I thought that would be a good way to find out more about how you could take the scientific advances that were coming through and translate them into new treatments.
But don't some critics feel doctors shouldn't work for pharmaceutical companies?
It has been a complicated relationship.
Because it blurs the line sometimes.
Yeah, it can blur the line. My approach to it has always been to be completely transparent. So, obviously I've talked to my bosses in the university about taking a role with GlaxoSmithKline. And whenever I talk, to anybody about my work, I make sure that they're aware that I have this dual role. I think where it can get problematic is when it's not so transparent, when it's not so obvious that doctors have a relationship with the industry.
But then just 5 years later, in 2010, GSK abruptly closed down its research and development programs in mental health. Why did they stop it so abruptly?
Well, I think, they made a decision which many other companies in the industry made at about the same time. I mean, that was not a decision unique to GSK, that the investment in finding new treatments for mental health disorders was not working out.
But it was promising, wasn't it?
If you have to go back really now to about 1990, the launch of Prozac and the first wave of serotonin reuptake inhibitors, that was really the last major advance in drug treatment. So by 2010, that's about 20 years later, many companies had invested in the area and there wasn't a great deal to show for it. As a business decision, I think it made sense. For me, it was something of a sort of, I would hesitate to call it an existential crisis, but it was certainly an epiphany.
Because you didn't become depressed, did you?
No, I didn't become depressed, but I did think hard. What is this telling us? If a company as big and, well-resourced as GSK can't see a way forward for development of new treatments for depression. how can we find a way forward? And, you know, I talked to a lot of people in the company, I talked to a lot of people outside the company, and it seemed to me that, you know, if we were going to find a way forward, it would have to be by a very different route to the way that people had gone about drug development in the past. And that really was the moment that led me to the ideas and the thinking that are central to the book we're talking about. So my response to the challenge, how could we do it differently, was to think, well, maybe it could make sense to target the immune system rather than directly going after neurotransmitters like serotonin in the brain.
So that led you to immunopsychiatry or neuroimmunology, as mm-hmm. it's sometimes called. What are they? You weren't the person who started.
No, absolutely not. It started, you know, if you go back and you sort of try and find the original roots of it, I would say the first papers that explicitly talked about inflammatory mechanisms in depression, probably published in the early 1990s. And I think that at that time, two kind of discoveries were made more or less at the same time. One was that if you measured inflammatory proteins in the blood of patients with depression, they were very often elevated. Not, you know, extremely elevated, but definitely significantly elevated compared to non-depressed people. That was one key observation.
Wouldn't the same sort of thing happen if somebody was just feeling stressed?
Well, we know that now, but, you know, back in the 1990s, we didn't know that. You know, so there was, you know, there was a, you know, quite a considerable controversy about what these results meant. And I believe that many of the early pioneers in the field faced considerable skepticism, almost ridicule, about the sort of believability of their results. Because it really, you know, the idea that inflammatory proteins that you could measure in the blood circulating the body could have anything to do with a state of mind like depression was at the time a very disruptive idea. It cut right across that dualist divide that we were talking about earlier between body and mind. And I think a lot of people thought well, this is just impossible.
What do the symptoms of what you call an inflamed mind look like? Can you give us an example of a study that might reveal it?
Well, I think that, you know, I think a lot of the symptoms of inflammation are depressive. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the, you know, one of the key ideas in the book. If you, you know, it's difficult, obviously, you know, for ethical reasons, we can't make people inflamed. We can make animals inflamed. You know, we can give animals an injection with the bacteria or some other kind of inflammatory stimulus, and we will very often see that their behavior changes as if they have become depressed. And there are a few natural experiments that have been quite informative. So people with hepatitis who were not depressed but had hepatitis used to be offered treatment with something called interferon, which is an inflammatory protein. It's quite an unpleasant treatment, but it's very effective in dealing with hepatitis. And one of the things that emerged out of that experiment was that if you make people severely inflamed by giving them a dose of interferon, about a third of them will become depressed six weeks or so later.
You're inducing depression, in effect, in treating something else.
Correct. And, you know, we call it a natural experiment because it's not an experiment you could ever ethically do if there wasn't a compelling medical reason why those people had to have treatment with interferon, but it does provide a very interesting insight.
But there are other ways that we are inflamed. You cite rheumatoid arthritis, for example, right. And you also offer yourself as an example to support the theory of inflammation-induced depression because of what happened to you after a root canal procedure.
Yeah. So this was another one of those kind of, you know, epiphanies. You know, I had an infected tooth, I had to have root canal treatment. I wasn't particularly looking forward to it, as you know. No, I don't think anybody would look forward to root canal. But I hopped up on the dentist chair feeling, you know, okay. He did the job. And I got home and I felt pretty gloomy. I didn't really want to talk to anybody. I went to bed. I found myself lying in bed, sort of, you know, ruminating on how long I had left to live in rather a sort of melancholic way. And the first story I told myself about that was a sort of psychological story. I thought to myself, you know, maybe this experience with the root canal, it's really telling me I am getting long in the tooth. Mm. You know, this is real proof, concrete proof.
Literally,
yeah.
Long the tooth.
Literally getting long in the tooth. I am getting close to the grave. It was a sort of psychological explanation. And then I thought, well, maybe there's another explanation. Maybe that dentist, you know, drilling around and filling around with my infected tooth had prompted a sort of release of inflammatory proteins into my circulation, and that's what was making me feel low and withdrawn from my family. I should say it didn't last long enough to amount to a kind of clinical depression, but you know, it was a day or two of feeling distinctly you know, off color. And I would guess quite a lot of us have had similar sort of experiences.
You also write about a woman with rheumatoid arthritis, which is an inflammatory disease. But some of the other things that you say could cause depression by inflammation are age, obesity, stress. Mm-hmm. They're not inflammatory conditions.
No.
I'm getting old. Is there some kind of inflammation in my brain just as a result of my advanced age?
Well, I haven't got a good way of measuring the inflammation in your brain. I think that goes back to this question of biomarkers, you know. But if you look, I think the important thing is to think about two kinds of inflamed depression, if you will. There are the people who have a major inflammatory disorder of the body, like arthritis, like that patient, Mrs. P, that I write about in the book. Now, a lot of those patients have psychological symptoms. It may be depression, it may be fatigue, is very common. A lot of people have this thing they call brain fog. They find it difficult to think clearly or to plan for the future. Now, these are psychological symptoms of physical inflammatory disease. Historically, you know, the medical profession has tended to see them not as part of the core arthritis. You know, it's, and I think this is what I get to in the story about Mrs. P. I think people have been encouraged to think, or the medical profession perhaps has encouraged people to think, if you're depressed and you've got arthritis, you're depressed because you're thinking about your arthritis. Whereas the alternative explanation is that the inflammatory process that's driving the arthritis is also directly causing the psychological symptoms.
Is this something that is being generally accepted within the medical community?
Well, if you look back to, you know, 1990, where this whole story started, and compare, you know, the climate of opinion then to how things stand now, I would say we're definitely moving in the right direction. It's, I would say, not yet mainstream, but I think it's rapidly gaining credibility.
And are treatments being developed? Because you have to treat inflammation of the brain, don't you? Is that where cytokines come in?
Yeah. So cytokines are I think of them as inflammatory hormones. You know, they're proteins that circulate in the blood and communicate within the immune system. So if you've got arthritis, for example, or even if, like me, you've had a bit of root canal surgery, you might have a high level of cytokines in circulation, and those inflammatory hormones can, we now know, signal information across from the blood into the brain.
So wouldn't they be biomarkers?
They could be biomarkers, yeah, and people are looking at them as potential biomarkers. I mean, there are some technical challenges in using cytokines as biomarkers. They're present at pretty low concentrations in there, and they vary considerably day to day and from person to person. So they might or might not be technically the best possible biomarker.
They cross the blood-brain barrier.
They can cross the blood-brain barrier in some parts of the brain, but they can also signal across the blood-brain barrier in other ways. So,
and what? How do they work within the brain?
Well, if you now you're getting into a question which is for which we have much better answers in animals than humans. But in animals, you can show that cytokines in the brain, these inflammatory signals, have effects on how nerve cells work. They make nerve cells less plastic, you know, less adaptive. They also change the way the nerve cells deal with serotonin. We were talking about serotonin earlier, and you know, one of the interesting angles of the whole immune story is that inflammation in the brain changes how nerve cells handle serotonin in a way which could help us to explain why people with inflammation and depression are particularly difficult to find it particularly difficult to respond to conventional serotonin boosting drugs.
You write that the changes being seen in neuroscience research are slow to affect treatment in clinics and hospitals. Mm-hmm. Are they just being ignored? Because I would think that some people would see this as a positive approach if you don't really know what to do with the patient.
Mm. I think, you know, medicine's always slow to change. And, you know, there are a lot of good reasons for that, actually. I mean, you know, you want to be really sure that a new treatment is going to be an advantage for patients before you rush in and provide it. So I think it's reasonable and it's right that there's a degree of sort of conservatism in medical practice. But I think also we've really got to push hard to make sure that the tremendous advances that we're seeing in neuroscience do carry across to deal with this national, you know, global public health problem that we were talking about at the start of the...
Is it the same everywhere?
What, in the world?
Yeah.
I don't think
I mean, we see depression on the same levels in Nepal as we would in Kenya and in Florida?
Well, it's, you know, it's difficult to
I'd be
judge.
Most depressed in Florida, of course.
But, you know, there's depression everywhere. I think what people find is that, you know, in less developed economies where, you know, the major public health challenges, for example, are going to be around infection, infant mortality and so on, mental health and depression tend to be less obvious. And then as societies become more prosperous and they deal with some of those kind of, you know, crucial health risks, mental health emerges more strongly as a cause of disability.
Many people with depression self-medicate with alcohol, with cannabis, opioids, other drugs. Mm-hmm. Do any of them have anti-inflammatory properties?
That's a good question. And I don't think we know the answer to that as well as we would like to understand it. I think one point that's worth bearing in mind here, I just want to emphasize, is that I'm not claiming that everybody with depression is inflamed. I think it's, you know, as far as we can tell from the data we have at the moment, it looks like maybe about a third of patients with a primary diagnosis of depression might have inflammation, and maybe about a quarter of patients with a medical inflammatory disorder have depression. So it's we're not talking about, I'm not trying to make a grandiose claim that this explains everything. But I think if we could find a good scientific explanation for a percentage of depression that opened the door to new treatments for that particular subgroup of patients, that would nevertheless be a big advance.
You primarily publish in academic journals. Is that in part why you decided to write a book for a mass audience?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I had never written anything like this before. And I was prompted to do it because, you know, having started to think about this in an ordinary academic way and talking to friends and family, and I discovered that also actually attracted a lot of media attention right from the get-go, I thought, well, maybe this is touching on some bigger questions, questions that resonate a little bit more widely than just a narrow academic focus. And I also think that some of the issues that this discussion raises, we've touched on today, about the relationship between mind and body in Western medicine. I thought those were ideas that I couldn't really write about in an academic paper, but I think I could write about in this more general format.
Are you hoping to destigmatize depression?
I think we'd all love to destigmatize mental health disorders. But as I said at the start, I think the best way to destigmatize disease is to understand it and to get control over it. So I think if we can, you know, it's good that we're talking about depression more, and I think we are, as you know, I think in the US and the UK for sure, there's more discourse, there's more discussion about depression than there used to be, and that's probably destigmatizing, and it's good. But what's really going to make a difference is if we've got new treatments.
There used to be a big difference between the way Americans look at psychiatry and the way Brits looked at psychiatry. Has that gap narrowed?
Yeah, I think it's narrowed quite a bit, yeah.
There are several illustrations in your book to help explain some of the technical immunology concepts. Figure 9 contrasts what you were taught in medical school to what we know now.
Yeah.
Can you explain that? We don't have a lot of time, but so, I found that fascinating. Yeah.
So I'm 58 now. And, you know, when I was in medical school, I graduated when I was 25. So we're talking about 30 years ago. And I find it instructive to look back and see what's changed. And I particularly find it gratifying to see how some of the things that we were taught as a matter of fact in medical school turn out not to be right. And one of the things that we were taught is that there's this blood-brain barrier
But there is
a blood-brain barrier. But we were taught that the blood-brain barrier was a bit like the Berlin Wall at the time. You know, it was completely impermeable. It prevented...
Oh, don't tell Donald Trump about that.
Yeah, we don't want to get into too many wall-related discussions. But, back in the 80s, the idea that, you know, an inflammatory disease like arthritis could cause symptoms like depression was just impossible because of the Berlin Wall-like concept we had about the blood-brain barrier at the time. And that's one of the things, you know, as the Berlin Wall has come down in Berlin, actually also the Berlin Wall in the brain has come down. And it's not like there's a complete, open door for anything in the circulation to get into the brain, but there are certainly many channels of communication which allow the immune system and the nervous system to talk to each other, which we just didn't know about back in the 1980s, and that's what I'm trying to capture in Figure 9.
In just a few moments we have left, what can you tell loved ones who are witnessing somebody going through a debilitating depression? Mm-hmm. What should they do?
Well, I think there's sort of three things, probably. I would say to people who are depressed or who have a loved one who's depressed, first is you're not alone. I think that's very important. You know, actually depression is very common, but one of the symptoms of depression is it tends to make people feel isolated. I think it's important for people to know that they're not alone. It's very common. I think another key point, which I've already touched on, is people should not feel ashamed about their symptoms. They should not feel it's their fault or they're not worthy or they deserve to be like this. All of those are symptoms of depression or could be symptoms of depression. And I think people need to be assertive about finding effective treatment. And that is where loved ones, I think, can play a key part, helping people to find treatment. And the third thing I'd say is healthy mind, healthy body. You know, so if you've got a physical disease like arthritis and you've got mental health symptoms, fatigue, depression, think of those as on par with each other. Try and seek treatment for both and deal with both the physical and mental health sides of your experience.
Edward Bullmore, Bullmore, is co-chair of Cambridge Neuroscience, scientific director of the Wolfson Brain Imaging Center, and head of the Department of Psychiatry at Cambridge University. His book, The Inflamed Mind, is published by Picador. Thanks so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard. It's been a great pleasure talking to you.
And that does bring us to the end of our show. My great thanks to Professor Edward Bullmore, to Kate Guan, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.